Open up the Senate Committee on Business and Transportation for Monday, March 30th. We have two bills on the agenda today. Should be interesting. We'll open up a public hearing. Senate Bill 915. Mr. Stembridge.
Chair Metzger, members of the committee, Senate Bill 915 requires that municipal penalties for violation of local building code be no more than penalties for violation of corresponding state building code provisions. It's got a lot more provisions in it, but you have the dash 2 from Senator Morris, which replaces the measure. I will describe that in a little more detail. It specifies components of municipal plans for enforcement of state building code, including enforcement procedure. It prohibits municipality from assessing criminal penalty when the same violation would be subject to state-level civil penalty. It prohibits municipality from assessing civil penalty greater than established for the same violation at the state level. It provides for appeal of denial of certificate of occupancy based on violation of specialty code. It provides for issuance of temporary certificate of occupancy in cases where structures have passed building code and fire and safety certification but are denied permanent certificate of occupancy for any other reason. Declares emergency effective upon passage. And, Mr. Chairman, this dash 2 replaces the measure.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Stembridge. This is sponsored by Senator Morris. So, Senator Morris, if you'd like to come forward. And you may bring a sidekick with you, Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Welcome, gentlemen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Frank Morse. I represent Senate District 8, Lynn Benton Counties, and serve in the Oregon Senate. And I thank you for the opportunity to bring this bill forward. And as the committee administrator has mentioned, the focus is on the Dash 2 amendments that essentially replace the bill. There are two underlying issues. The first issue is whether a building code violation can be prosecuted under the Criminal Procedures Code in municipal court. And that's a fundamental question. The second issue is the need to clarify that citizens must have due process regarding enforcement of the building codes. Now, Mr. Chair and colleagues, this bill arises out of a most unfortunate circumstance that occurred in the city of Corvallis. And Ian McElroy is going to testify and will explain the process and the history that he encountered in the city of Corvallis that gave genesis to this bill. While I have included in my testimony a brief summary of his journey through this process, I will let him tell his story. Best for him to do that. Now, I recognize that in bringing this bill forward, I'm somewhat conflicted because I represent the city of Corvallis, but I also represent the citizens of my district and the citizens of Oregon. And this is one of those times that I look back on my business career and I'm reminded of the admonishment that I gave to my employees, and that was, do the right thing. Do what's right, not just what is expedient. And that's really the focus of this bill, I think, is to clarify existing statutes so that municipalities are led to do the right thing, not just what they have the perceived power to do. I would reference in my testimony the fact on page 2, the city believes it has the right to enforce the building code through the Criminal Procedures Code in municipal court. Corvallis Municipal Court Judge Donahue on March 26, 2008, in response to a motion based on the Oregon Rules of Civil Procedure to set aside the convictions of Mr. Elroy, wrote a finding as follows, and I'd like to quote that. The current motion is also not a civil action. The underlying citation and procedure used here are not part of a civil action. Because a fine can be imposed, they are part of a violation procedure, ORS 153.008, sub 1, sub C. As such, ORS 153.030 applies criminal procedures laws to violations. Those procedure laws set out in ORS chapters 131 to 153 are clearly different from the civil procedure rules set out in the Oregon Rules of Civil Procedure. The current motion is an attempt to reverse the punishment, bail forfeiture, in a violation case. So that's a fundamental issue. When you have a civil violation of a building code, does that enforcement appropriately fall under the criminal procedures code that you find in municipal court, or should there be a civil procedures process? And that's what this bill attempts to clarify. Now, I had asked legislative counsel for an opinion, and you should have a draft of that opinion for your review. But I would quote from that opinion a couple of salient points. And I read from legislative counsel's opinion. This opinion addresses the single question of whether a municipality, city, or county authorized to administer the state building code as a municipal ordinance may assess a criminal penalty for a violation of that municipal ordinance. We conclude that a municipality may not do so in those instances where the state building code provides that violation of the code is subject to a civil penalty. So here you have the dilemma of a violation of the code that's civil being adjudicated in a court of law that's directed by criminal procedures codes. And from the policy of the state, is that what we want to have happen? The opinion letter further states in the state, and the citation goes to case law, in State versus Tyler, and I won't read the citation, which happened to be in 2000. The court held that where the Legislative Assembly has made a policy decision that a particular group of violations is to be treated as non-criminal, a municipal ordinance that criminalizes violations of the same nature and character is invalid. Additionally, the opinion states, although the statutes lack an express statement directly on point in view of the overall statutory scheme, we believe the Legislative Assembly has clearly indicated an intent that, with specific exceptions such as ORS 480.525 sub 4 penalty, state building code violations and building requirement violations are to be subject to sanction by civil penalties. We also conclude that the policy is intended to operate uniformly throughout the state. And I would point out the language of the Dash 2 amendments that it clarifies statutes that call for civil penalties for violation of the building codes. Quote, may not assess a criminal penalty for violation of that code provision or for the violation of a municipal ordinance, rule, or regulation that encompasses the same matter as the code provision. Additionally, the bill clarifies that, and I again quote, penalty imposed by a municipality in enforcing that code provision or enforcing a municipal ordinance, rule, or regulation that encompasses the same matter as that code provision may not exceed the penalty amount authorized under the schedule of penalties established by the director of the advisory board. The bill further clarifies that a denial of a certificate of occupancy based on violation of a specialty code shall provide due process for an appeal. Now, colleagues, this bill is not, and I repeat, is not an attempt to diminish the authority and the power of local government to enforce codes. What it is to clarify under what venue and what process should be used that provides access for citizens to have an appeal process and to move through in a way that is not in, if it's a civil violation, can it be adjudicated through criminal procedures court? That's a fundamental question. Legislative counsel is saying no, that's really not the proper venue. This is not an attempt to diminish the authority, but to put it into a rational format that provides a clear process to move forward. And I thank you very much, Mr. Chair and colleagues, for this opportunity to bring this bill forward. Now, the testimony that you will be receiving from Ian McElroy will give you the background of how this problem has emerged and why this bill is a necessary bill for us to consider. But I would like to make one declaration. Mr. McElroy has been known to me for quite a number of years. He came to me with this problem shortly after I came into the legislature. And as you will learn from his experience, he was literally destroyed by the city of Corvallis in this process, and was literally destitute and without means. I have, and my wife, have loaned Ian McElroy funds to help him. And what I've also done and will have before you tomorrow is an affidavit that clarifies that where I have loaned him in the past or may loan him in the future, any repayment, if any, will be given to the Boys and Girls Club of Corvallis and will be given to the Boys and Girls Club of Albany for charitable purposes, so that my interest in my past history as I have followed Ian McElroy will not be a conflict of interest. It will be a charitable donation to the communities if there is any repayment, if Mr. McElroy ever has the resources in the future to repay me and my wife Linda the loans that we have given. So I want to make that abundantly clear so that there's no misunderstanding. And if this bill moves to the floor, I'll provide that affidavit. I will file that affidavit with the Ethics Commission so that there's complete knowledge of my role in this process and its ultimate consequence in Senate Bill 915. So, Mr. Chair, I thank you for that opportunity to testify and bring this forward.
Thank you, Senator. Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. My name is Andy Olson, and I'm state representative out of the Albany area. And just would like to take just a few minutes of your time to share why I support Senate Bill 915, especially from a retired police officer's perspective. Having served 29 years with the Oregon State Police, a member of the agency comes to know tradition. And as a result of that, you also come to know what rules, regulations, and policies are as well. During the recruit school, you must memorize dozens of verbatims as a rite of passage to move forward to become a trooper someday. It's been 35 years since I went through recruit school, but to this date I still recall a verbatim that all of us were to memorize that came from a quote that our first superintendent of the Oregon State Police made when the department started August 1st, 1931. That was Charles P. Prey. But this is what he said. A peace officer is the image of penal law and its warden. If he is to be esteemed and the law he typifies respected, he must know his authority well and use it wisely. He must neither exceed nor abuse it. And that concept is deeply embedded to me to this date, and I believe that all those who have been given authority should apply that concept as well. Whether one is in public or private sector, whether you're employed or work for the city, county, state, or federal government, or whether you're man or woman, it should apply. And the public has entrusted you with power, and it should never exceed nor abuse it. Senate Bill 915 rights the wrong that has occurred. The city of Corvallis has exceeded their authority and abused it. The Corvallis city officials initiated criminal action against Ian McElroy in November 1998. For alleged occupancy violation of the state building code, and did so without any notice of civil penalty, as required under ORS 183-745. While Mr. McElroy has successfully completed the commercial building at issue, the building official withheld the necessary certificate of occupancy contrary to the provisions of OSSC Section 109, which is the Oregon Structural Specialty Code, the state code. Rather than following Oregon's statutory provision for an administrative contested case process, whereby citizens are provided opportunity to challenge a building official's decision related to building code, a process intended to bring a building or development into compliance with the codes, the Corvallis Municipal Court instead used the Oregon Criminal Code to convict Mr. McElroy and did so without a trial or hearing or due process of law. I have attached a copy of a handwritten memo from then-Lieutenant Ron Noble of the Corvallis City Police Department. And this memo was obtained through Mr. McElroy's attorney, Richard Rodman, since retired, through a request for production of documents from the City of Corvallis Attorney Office 10 years ago. The memo is from Lieutenant Noble to the City Attorney's Office, Shelley, who was at that time with the city attorney's office legal assistant. Dan Carlson was at the time the building inspector who signed the citations against Mr. McElroy. Today, Dan Carlson is the Corvallis building official, and Jim Brewer, the city attorney, is the individual who wrote out the citations directing the city police department to serve them on Mr. McElroy. These citations were served between November 9th to the 25th, 1998. The point that I wanted to share with you on that, for that memo, that Lieutenant Ron Noble, who's now the chief of McMinnville Police Department, was he had a question as to whether or not he was in a position legally to move forward with even serving those citations. And finally, there should have never been a connection between the civil process of this case to the criminal process. Clearly, this was a case of abuse of authority. Senate Bill 915 would correctly protect citizens from governmental agencies exceeding and abusing their authority, as what occurred in the McElroy case. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. Questions for either of our colleagues?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I'd like to remain at the table and invite Ian McElroy and Greg Merton to testify.
Okay. Mr. Merton and Mr. McElroy, please.
Hello, my name is Greg Merton, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm here as a friend of Ian, having gotten involved in this many years ago. I was general manager and vice president of Hewlett-Packard operations in Corvallis, having been there quite a while, through the development of that business. And Ian, in his, I guess, frustration in trying to figure out somehow how to get redressed for what was going on, had come to me and asked for some help, and so I got involved at that time and have been following this case for a number of years. And as I've become familiar with it, it seems to me that it's clear that the state established a review process, a civil review process, in matters of complex building code so that the right thing could be done in behalf of citizens as well as in the behalf of the state in wanting to have buildings that were quality buildings and serve the purposes they were for which they were intended, thereby eliminating the possibility that cities could just decide on their own recognizance or their own opinion about how things should proceed, because these matters are sometimes complex and code can never be written to cover all eventualities. So an independent third-party board was established in order to adjudicate those kinds of disputes. That's my understanding, and it makes a lot of sense. What Corvallis has done instead is to short-circuit that process. That board hasn't met for years, and go to a municipal court criminal process, as has already been explained, with citations issued by police officers with very onerous fines in order to force their point of view. Now, in my sense, the fundamental error here is that might does not automatically make right. I think this country was established in disagreement with that, or in agreement with that principle. And so when a governmental body which has oppressive power or can exercise oppressive power uses that power against a citizen who's normally very vulnerable in these kinds of circumstances, then a lot of mischief can occur. And fundamentally, I think it's important to recognize that the citizens in the city are no more capable, inherently, no more capable than the citizens, other citizens, like the builders or the contractors. They have no special access to being unbiased, to being unemotional, and being accurate than any other citizens do. And that's why this third-party review process was established, that the city of Corvallis has decided not to use. And because they have might, they can short-circuit that review process and that examination of the actual dispute and the merits of that dispute and simply force their way. And they do it with citation and onerous fines, and the person is left in a corner with no place to go. And that's oppressive use of power, which is the definition of tyranny. Oppressive use of power. And perhaps the most compelling argument, I think, in favor of bridling the use of that kind of power is that in the end, the city of Corvallis was in error in the dispute. The dirt's still there. The ADA, State ADA Board, ruled in favor of Mr. McElroy.
Mr. Merton, if you don't mind, I think we're kind of backwards here. You're explaining the case, and we haven't heard the case. So okay. I appreciate it. Why don't we get Mr. McElroy to tell us what happened, and then if there's nothing to add, because the committee's going to be a little confused here, if that's okay.
Okay.
Mr. McElroy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm going to really
start with your name, please.
My name is Ian McElroy.
Thank you.
And I will do my best to make this very brief. For the record, I have submitted a 10-page summary of my story, but do not intend to read it, nor try and cover everything in there. But I did want some of the very basic, essential facts to at least be in the record, something for the committee that could afterwards review and consider. In 1995, I purchased a four-acre piece of property in Corvallis, zoned for commercial offices. I applied for and in 1996 received full approvals from the city of Corvallis. In late 97, I started building the development. In March of 98, I finished the first of the three buildings. The city passed all of the pertinent inspections. There were a couple of items that needed to be concluded. The city, using their policy, their established policy for issuing temporary certificates, which the policy says in part, the city always works with developers to allow early occupancy for financial and other reasons. The city and I established a punch list. I think that one was three or four items. I signed it in agreement that I will complete those in a timely fashion. And once that occurs, the city would issue the final certificate. That eventually happened. But with the approvals in hand, my first tenant, First American Title Insurance Company, moved in and began providing escrow services to the community. By late September 1998, I finished the second larger building. Once again, the city passed all the inspections. We created a short punch list. They issued the temporary certificates of occupancy. David Evans, an engineering firm, moved in, began resuming their business operations. I would like to mention, I'm not going to cite many of the state laws, but in particular, ORS 455020 states the purpose of the building code. This chapter is enacted to enable the director of the DCBS to promulgate a state building code, the OSSC, to govern the construction of buildings. The state code shall establish uniform performance standards providing reasonable safeguards for health, safety, welfare, comfort and security of residents of this state who are occupants and users of those buildings. So as you can see from the first two tenant improvement spaces and that I completed for our tenants, the performance standards that were established under the state law and under the city's codes as authorized by the statute those performance standards worked perfectly to serve and protect the community's welfare. Occupancies were granted, business were able to relocate and resume operations, employees in the community were able to continue in their work, and the office park, River Green Office Park, was able to collect the rents and pay the mortgage, all because the system worked as intended. 2 weeks later, however, I finished some medical offices on the first floor of the second building. Just like before, the city passed all the inspections, confirmed the offices were ready for occupancy. However, instead this time of issuing the certificates like before, the city intentionally withheld the occupancy certificates in order to prevent the occupancy, because the city had gotten mad at me in regard to an issue not related to the building or the permits for that building, but some landscaping and grading requirements outside the building. As Senator Morris mentioned, according to the facts of the case, the Corvallis and city officials intentionally misused the state building code as the hammer in which to punish me personally, because under the state and local land use laws, the disputed issues regarding the grading and landscape issues had been stalemated by an appeal that I had filed to LUBA. Under the city's own land development code, 2.19.30.07 states, in regard to the effective date of a decision, approval of any development request shall become effective upon expiration of the appeal period unless an appeal has been filed. That appeal period is 21 days. On the advice of my then attorney, we filed an appeal to LUBA. It rendered the city's decision to eliminate the fill dirt, which was one of the disputed issues, rendered that decision ineffective. Not only that, the city later withdrew their decision for reconsideration. So at the time, the city was withholding the certificate of occupancy. Not only was the decision ineffective, but it didn't even exist because the city withdrew it by the filing of some documents with LUBA. Notwithstanding, the city decided they were going to enforce their decision regardless that it didn't even exist. But the city couldn't do anything under the land development code, so it used the certificate of occupancy under the building code to then punish me and try and force me to comply with their decision. It should be noted that a year later, I did finally force the city to the Oregon State Structural Building Code Structures Board, the state board at the Building Code Division, where in that proceeding, the state board found in my favor, ruling that the city's decision regarding the very initial ADA dispute, which was removing the dirt and the sidewalk behind the building, that the city's decision violated state and federal ADA laws. So I eventually won the issue, but in the meantime, the city wouldn't give me the certificates because I wouldn't perform the work. It is important to understand that the many complicated events, which were completing the medical offices, passing the inspections, asking for the certificate, being coerced to break the law, ADA laws, being denied the certificate, and making the decision not to bankrupt Dr. Gallant's practice, and making the decision to allow occupancy rather than bring harm to hundreds of patients, citizens in the community who would be showing up at the offices in just 4 days, all of those things took place in just a couple of hours on October 8, 1998. There was no time for negotiations, filing appeals to the Board of Appeals, or court actions. I could not put the doctor out of practice. I had no choice but to allow the doctor to move in. So the doctor did move in. 4 days later, he reopened his practice to his patients, and for the past 10 years, he has not suffered any harm. The doctor is still there. In the meantime, the following month, the City of Corvallis police officers started showing up at the office park while I was beginning to prepare the final three tenant improvement spaces on the first floor of the second building. The police issued me four citations over the course of 2 or 3 weeks, and the city attorneys initiated four separate criminal proceedings against me in the Corvallis Municipal Court. In response to the citations, my attorney filed not guilty pleas with the municipal court. 10 years later, I understand that my attorney should have filed a motion to dismiss for lack of jurisdiction, because a municipal court of limited criminal jurisdiction does not have jurisdiction over the state building code. I didn't understand that. My attorney didn't understand it. I then endured 9 months of criminal proceedings against me that led up to a trial in July of 1999. By the time we got to trial, I had incurred over $60,000 in attorney defense fees trying to resolve the ADA and the building code issues and defending myself against the criminal prosecution. There's a number of events that occurred that the week before and leading up to the trial that are not necessarily have to do with the purpose of this bill. They are important, and I would encourage you to read the events starting in the middle of page 6 that led up to the convictions. The principal argument for what the purpose and the reason why this bill occurred is because the state legislature has established law that provides a civil penalty, administrative civil penalty process whenever a building code violation is alleged to have taken place. That process provides an extraordinary complex set of due process procedures of notices, and the notices require this municipality to identify what the person's exactly what the violation is and the rights and remedies of the person, to proceed and file for contested case hearings before an administrative law judge at the building code division. The purpose of the civil penalty process is to provide a means to resolve the building code violation. It's to encourage people to build safe buildings, to bring building code problems in compliance with the law. And after the exhaustive administrative process, if a building code violation is then determined to exist, then the person still has usually 30 days to correct the problem before a civil penalty is imposed. All of that is circumvented, and none of those due process rights are afforded when a person instead is cited into a municipal court through criminal proceedings. So there is literally no means to be afforded due process of law and to resolve the building code violations. My case is case in point. 10 years later, the ADA violation that I claimed existed because of the city's actions have never been resolved. Because there is an ADA violation, the certificates of occupancy that the city finally issued to the LLC property owners is under state law, the OSSC 109.1. The certificates are deemed invalid because the ADA violation exists on the property. So therefore, 10 years later, although I've been criminally convicted and punished while being denied all due process of law, the criminal proceedings did not and cannot be resolved through a court of criminal law. It's not possible. Under the state's building code, when there is a violation that exists or there's a dispute that arises between a property owner or a contractor and the decision of a building official, there's one single venue in the state of Oregon under our laws that is created to resolve the building code dispute, and that is a professional board of construction experts who are trained and experienced to pass on matters related to the building code. And the building code violation isn't resolved by one judge wearing a black robe making a decision, but instead is a group of professionals who vote on the matter. So it's truly a dire situation when a person could be alleged to have violated the building code, denied all means to resolve the building code dispute, and instead is forced into a criminal court that has no means for resolving or defending against the building code violation, because a court has no means to make a determination whether or not a building code violation exists. So citizens are put in terrible risk of being denied due process and being forced into a situation where they're harmed for lack of due process. This bill is very significant in the fact that the Corvallis Municipal Court has recently determined that it does in fact have jurisdiction and that a violation proceeding can be resolved either through the administrative process or the municipal court. But the Oregon Constitution, Article 3, Section 1, is very clear. The government of this state is divided into three different departments: legislative, executive, which includes administrative, and judicial. And no officer charged with the duty of one department shall perform any function of another. It is not possible for a judge wearing a black robe in a criminal municipal court to step into the shoes of a group of professional experts and make a decision for them. The Constitution prohibits it. So how can it be possible for the laws to be partly vague that would allow a municipality to argue and successfully succeed in saying, we have the authority to criminally prosecute a state building code violation? And most significantly, under ORS 455040, which requires that the state building code shall be applicable and uniform throughout the state and in all municipalities, then how is it that Beaverton is different than Tigard, is different than Bend, is different from Ashland, is different from Corvallis? A builder can go in different cities and be successful in one city and then be destroyed in another because of this unequal ability of, in particular, the city of Corvallis to choose to do what they want, how they want it, irregardless of the law. And citizens are at risk if this bill is not passed. And I thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Ms. McElroy. I appreciate that, you know, substance of that. So just a very brief synopsis, and I have read this stuff, is that you believe that the city council and essentially through their powers in denying you this issue, which led to you personally being charged, was primarily over a grading issue that you believed, which they said, which you believe, had you followed what they wanted you to do, would have violated ADA. They wanted you essentially to do something that was in violation of ADA. You did not want to do that. You had a dispute on that. They charged you criminally, which you believe is illegal, and Senator Morris has presented some evidence from our attorneys that suggests that that was. But and then also seems like you had some problems with your own attorneys that you may not have been able to rectify, and which did not necessarily give you the best advice either. And we're kind of at this stage now where, as you continue to pursue this case, is, you know, you're hopeful that this won't be applied to anyone else. That's a very short summary, but is that kind of the general gist of what I'm hearing, other than the very many specifics of your case?
You've done a very good job summarizing it. I would say that it's very easily to be confused by the city of Corvallis, because they will say, well, this was a land use issue. The problem is the decision, even in the context of a land use hearing, where the city of Corvallis says, we want you to eliminate the sidewalk. But under the state building code, under Chapter 11 of the state building code, which is the Americans with Disability Act, is adopted by the state, says that the access shall be required. So it's not discretionary. Even under the land use laws, Chapter 197, it identifies what are not land use decisions. And a matter that is not discretionary, therefore, is not a land use decision. But the city is prohibited by ORS 455-440, which says no municipality may enact or enforce any ordinance, rule, or regulation that otherwise changes the building code. So even in the context of a land use hearing, the city is prohibited from the statute from making the decision in the first place. In my case, the city made that decision unlawfully and then forced me into proceeding after proceeding where I had no means to argue it, but yet because the law doesn't contemplate necessarily fixing something that actually can't happen. So all these things happen to me, but there's no laws that prevent my remedy. And in fact, the criminal codes, ORS chapters 131 through 169, I've been locked into a criminal process that provides no remedy whatsoever. In fact, it prohibits my remedies in the building code realm, the administrative realm. This is, building codes are administrative function, but under the Administrative Act. And so to take that and ring somebody through criminal proceedings with no remedy, while denying the remedy, the administrative remedies in the legislature intended, is really preposterous. And it doesn't work. It's a broken system when it's applied that way.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. McElroy. I'm just watching our timer. We have two big issues today. I got more people, so I'm going to take a few minutes for questions of this panel, and then we'll hear from the city and others. Questions, Senator Berger.
Yes, I have a question. Thank you for your testimony. You said here that 4 days ago, the circuit court issued a writ of mandamus commanding the municipal court judge to set aside or vacate entirely the charges against you. How did that happen?
To be clear, this bill, if passed, will certainly protect every citizen in the future. This bill has no ability, if this bill were to pass into law, it would not require the municipal court to set aside my convictions. It's not retroactive to me. So I am, through legal proceedings and after discovery, that when a court does not have jurisdiction then anything that flows from it, including the judgment, is a legal nullity. It's void. Under more than 130 years of Oregon court history, the courts have held consistent that a judgment that is void for lack of jurisdiction, there is no discretion. The court must set it aside, and there is no statute of limitation. So where I had dozens of lawyers who never figured out the court had no jurisdiction, I learned that, and based on that, I have now a law firm in Portland that is working to set aside the convictions. So those are other legal proceedings. We have moved the municipal court to set aside the convictions. In January, the court said, we're denying your motion. We have jurisdiction. So we have now filed a writ of mandamus in the circuit court with a petition and the orders, and I think on Thursday of this past week, Judge David Connell of the Benton County Circuit Court issued an order ordering Judge Gardner of the Corvallis Municipal Court to set aside my convictions or to show up in court on April 28th, I believe, of this week.
One quick follow-up, Mr.
Yeah.
Chair. And are these the same attorneys that failed to notify you of your other legal proceedings?
No, all of those attorneys have been gone a long time,
okay.
And they're just sitting around waiting to collect on judgments against the proceedings.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Any other questions? Okay, thank you. I need to get on as soon as possible to the other side.
Right,
so.
But I would like to just conclude, Mr. Chair, members. The Ian McElroy case is ongoing, and I would ask that we not get caught up in all of that. And this is a bill that looks forward. It does not look back, and you'll notice that we did take out Section 6 of the the look-back provision, and that look-back provision was to afford Ian McElroy the opportunity to get back before the board, and I asked Legislative Council, oh, let's just take it out, because it's really irrelevant. The bill looks forward. And what will be the process?
Thank all three of you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, Charles Tomlinson, Dave Barenberg, and Hank McDonald, please.
Dave is on his way. He's currently testifying another.
Whoever.
Start, please do.
Okay. Chair Metzger, members of the Business and Transportation Committee, for the record, my name is Charles Tomlinson. I'm the mayor of the city of Corvallis. My address is City Hall, 501 Southwest Madison Avenue, Corvallis, Oregon. The city of Corvallis opposes Senate Bill 915, and I will summarize my written testimony, which you have a copy of. The City of Corvallis finds that the enforcement of the State Building Code in a fair, equitable, and uniform manner throughout Oregon is a concern for us as well. We conclude that there is ample evidence that the current state law defined in the various sections of ORS 455 offers clear public policy direction for the enforcement of the state specialty codes, and this public policy works well. We find that the 2007 Uniform Building Code in Section 110.2, which addresses Certificate of Occupancy provisions, provides for the issuance of a Certificate of Occupancy by the building official if that building official finds no violation of the code or other laws that are enforced by the Department of Building Safety, and that is my italicization, if you will. In Corvallis, these other laws include our body of land use legislation, including our comprehensive plan and land development code. We conclude that the Uniform Building Code provides for not only the enforcement of the specialty code, but local laws as well. If a developer is in violation of local land use laws, for example, conditions of approval arising from land use public hearings, we cite that individual to municipal court, referencing this section of the Uniform Building Code. This citation process is utilized infrequently. We've issued 12 citations in the past 15 years, and I'll also include that citations are generally civil and not criminal, infractions at the municipal court level. We find ORS 455.690, appeal to advisory boards limits appeals to, which I will quote, technical and scientific determinations related to the applications of the specialty code involved. We conclude that the enforcement of other local laws is outside the scope of ORS 455.690, given that statute's specificity. We oppose Senate Bill 915 because it provides for retroactive appeals of certificates of occupancy. Please refer to Section 6 of the bill. Retroactivity provisions are blind to the repercussions on Oregon municipalities and are without reasonable bias. I'll note also that the Dash 2 amendment continues to include, from our perspective, if a case is currently on appeal, that this new legislation applies as a look back to that case. Lastly, we note that the bill eliminates the encouragement of experimentation, innovation, and cost effectiveness by municipalities. We conclude there's no reasonable rationale for the deletion of these benefits to all Oregonians, and we'll also note that the Dash 2 amendments, as well as the Dash 1 amendment, seems to have overcome that issue, that would remain in ORS. I want to thank you for the opportunity to testify today, and I'd be happy to answer any of your questions.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. I think we'll go to Mr. Barenberg first, and Berg, if you want to see if you have some questions.
I'm Mr. McDonald.
Mr. McDonald. He didn't show up. Okay, Mr. McDonald, welcome.
Thank you very much, Senator Metzger and members of the committee. I'm Hank McDonald on behalf of the City of Portland. I'm with the Bureau of Development Services Commercial Inspections Division. I'm here today to testify in opposition of Senate Bill 915. There are a number of issues in the Senate bill that we're somewhat concerned about. Clearly, what we've heard up to this point is that there was a dispute between, you know, a developer and a jurisdiction. But what we have here is we have an attempt to solve a problem that maybe is localized. We don't have a systemic problem in the state of Oregon that building departments are using certificates of occupancy or criminal investigations or criminal procedures, to brutalize developers. I mean, we didn't hear that. In the city of Portland, we have a very aggressive appeal process. In fact, we have several levels of appeal process. There is no decision that can be made by any building code official in the city of Portland that is not appealable from the building official on down to the lowest level. All of those appeals are heard by our administrative appeal board. That appeal board meets on a weekly basis and hears in as many as 27 to 30 appeals, not all of them based on decisions, some of them based on code interpretation and or application. If an appellate is aggrieved by the decision of that board, that appeal can be moved on to what we call our Building Codes Board of Appeals, or the Big Board, and this is a collection of developers, real estate brokers, contractors that are members of the public, and they may adjudicate that appeal. And after that, there are still levels of appeal to those decisions. If we have a compliance action wherein we find that somebody has violated any provision of our city ordinances or the building code, we also have several levels of appeal that include quasi-judicial hearings processes before hearings officers, where all of the cases are presented and decisions are made after a careful weighing of all the evidence that's provided therein. Our concern with Senate Bill 915 is that it would remove some of the blocks, some of the building blocks that are critical to the way our system works. We believe that it short-circuits some of our level of appeal. We try to make decisions at the lowest possible level. We don't go to municipal courts, circuit courts, or any other of the judicial system until we believe that we have absolutely exhausted every level of appeal at the local level. We also, much like other jurisdictions, do use the building code and the certificate of occupancy to ensure that all of the rules within the jurisdiction are in fact followed. For example, a person may build a building and there may be all of the required fire life safety provisions. However, there may not be a street with a curb, gutter, sidewalk. There may not be other infrastructure improvements that are required. And once the occupancy of that building is allowed, it becomes very difficult for the jurisdiction to go back and try to get remedy for the lack of these infrastructure improvements. You know, compliance has never been anything that we have even gotten close to cost recovery on. And so we choose to make this thing
you know, not go to, you know, extremes. We choose to get this stuff identified and resolved as early as possible. And we very proactively go out on sites on a daily basis to look for problems that may be emerging so that we can identify those and resolve those prior to the time that occupancy, you know, appears to be, you know, inevitable. We also use the temporary certificate of occupancy program. We also use a bonding program. In this bill, we would be restricted to just the cost of the improvements that are required. In the city of Portland, we typically go with 150% of those costs, mainly because the costs are very regularly understated, and by the time those bonds are having to be collected, frequently the expense to do some of the infrastructure improvements is in excess of what was originally proposed. So, I mean, 915 takes away some of the most critical elements of our appeal process and our ability to make sure that all of the ordinances of the City of Portland and the statutes of the State of Oregon are, in fact, complied with. So I appreciate the opportunity to be able to come here today and talk about Senate Bill 915 and would urge opposition to that Senate bill.
Thank you, Mr. McDonald. I just have a question, then I'll ask the committee for some questions. In your experience in Portland, right?
Correct.
Have you ever issued a criminal complaint against someone without having exhausted all your statutorily civil procedures for negotiating issues relating to building code violations?
No, we have not.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions for the mayor or Senator Verger?
Yes, I'm just curious as to how far you feel that it should go as far as the using the certificate of occupancy as a tool. In other words, can you continue to add on more and more requirements that it be green, that it be a green building, that it can't be painted but tan and gray? How far are you willing to go?
Well, quite frankly, once we issue our final violation notice, if there are in fact violations, that's the end of it. We don't propose to go any further than that. We don't propose to go into anything that was not originally required as a part of the agreement under which we issued the building permit. That agreement would be the plans and the specifications. It may also include a land use review, which our land use review people in the City of Portland conduct these things very regularly. All of the findings are very well specified. We propose to not go outside of those requirements at all.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Senator George.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Gentlemen, I'm a person who went in for a land use permit that was an outright permitted use in state law, and due to time constraints, basically the local jurisdiction was going to be able to either hold me up or I had to go through the conditional use permit, which cost me about quadruple the cost. And so I see opportunities where local governments, even though it's clear in state law, use their own local power to, in essence, force the landowner to go through a series of obstacles that probably aren't intended in state law. Seems like to me that this bill says that we can't go into the criminal procedure unless that's allowed in state law. I mean, you don't have these dual systems. To me, to level this, it seems really important. What would be the justification for allowing a municipality to go into criminal court when the state path under the state building codes is a civil violation? What's the justification for sending somebody to criminal court for what is a civil situation?
Senator Metzger and Senator George, I want to make two comments. First is, we do not cite into municipal court criminal violations. We cite infractions. I want the committee to understand that. You've heard from folks that the criminal infractions, but I can supply you with the infraction notices that were issued in a particular case in Corvallis to indicate that they were civil infractions, not criminal. That's first. Second, the 2007 Uniform Building Code in Section 110, around Certificate of Occupancy, does state that we have the ability to enforce local law. And as you've heard, some jurisdictions use that certificate of occupancy as the lever to enforce the land use conditions of approval that are arisen through public hearings or through outright use through staff. We don't think it's appropriate for the appropriate specialty board to have to adjudicate Corvallis land use conditions of approval, because their application is very narrow according to ORS 455.690.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. But isn't that the whole point? I mean, in essence, what you're doing is that you have law over here that you're using a lever to enforce over here. And if you've got a problem enforcing the land use laws, then perhaps the state statute ought to give you an additional lever. But to go over here and use this lever creates anomalies like what we're talking about in the case we heard. And so it seems like to me that once you allowed the police force to file whatever criminal or whatever infraction, you open up this door for abuses or a miscarriage of justice. There has to be some way to solve this problem, not only for the individual situation, but perhaps situations in the future. And you see what I'm saying? You're using a lever over here to solve a problem over here, and it's clearly created a hole in the law.
Senator Mexter, Senator George, as you know, the Land Use Board of Appeals is an appeal process for land use decisions, which is there. The City of Corvallis head of the Board of Appeals, and according to City Charter, anybody can appeal an administrative rule to the City Council. So we have that in place, much as Portland does. But when it comes down to enforcing our other local laws, which are called out in the Uniform Building Code, we use that certificate of occupancy to do that. It seems to me that if you wanted to not have that happen, that you'd be changing the specialty codes in the ORS to broaden them and give them the same powers that the Land Use Board of Appeals has, which we think makes no sense.
Thank you, John. We have about 15 more minutes for this particular bill today. So with that in mind, I've got four more people have asked to testify. So John Cedars, Ann Hannes, Dan Eisenbees, if you want to come forward. He's going to be on. Welcome.
I'm John Cedars.
John, go ahead.
Chairman, Senator Metzger, members of the committee, my name is John Cedars, 2836 Northwest 29th, Corvallis, Oregon, and I represent myself, although I do have a dog in this fight. I support the proposed Senate Bill 915, including the amendments of 32609. As an engineer in civil and structural registered in the state of Oregon, I'm suitably familiar with the building codes as they develop and are adopted. They form a substantial basis of the criteria for the work that I do. I've become aware that there are issues in the building code that give different interpretations by different jurisdictions charged with code compliance. And that as a result, it is possible for a citizen in one community to be treated differently than in another. This creates an inequality before the law depending on where you practice your building trade. There are remedies to resolve such issues. However, if the remedies in the code are not employed or are vague enough to allow different interpretations or are abrogated, then equality before the law can result. I'm of the persuasion that after having read Senate Bill 915, that the proposed changes will remedy the possibilities of misinterpretation that I have mentioned.
Thank you, John. Thank you very much. Ms. Hannes.
Hi. For the record, my name is Ann Hannes, and I'm with the Association of Oregon Counties. My testimony is going to focus on the -2 amendments with Senate Bill 915. We think it's good to have a clear and transparent process to resolve disputes in a timely fashion. I'm not going to comment on the particulars of this case, but I'm going to look at the statewide look at this from a statewide basis and offer some suggestions for the bill. In Section Two, there may be instances where a municipality needs to charge more than the state schedule, and sometimes municipalities, counties try to run their programs without a general fund support and need to recoup the cost. So we would urge that there be some flexibility there in recognition of the county budget situation. In Section 3, the current law encourages experimentation and innovation, and providing this ability gives flexibility and recognizes there are new techniques and materials are constantly being developed. Plus, collaborative approaches can result in better approaches to reduce conflict. We're pleased to see that some of this language was restored in the Dash 2 amendments, but we're unsure why some of the lines 26 to 30 on page 2 and 1 to 4 on page 3 were deleted. And then in Section 4, it sets forth a process for appeals for a denial decision to a municipal appeals board. This varies around the state in terms of whether or not some use a board or some use a hearings officer, and we ask for some flexibility there about how to hear that appeal. And then lastly, we suggest that in order to post a surety bond, applicant must pass fire and life safety compliance, and that also you may consider, you know, what to set that bond at in terms of a percentage of what the estimated cost is. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Chair Metzger, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Daniel Eisenbeiss, League of Oregon Cities. I'll try not to belabor the points that you've already heard today, but speak briefly to the bill as introduced and the Dash 2 amendments. The League of Oregon Cities opposes Senate Bill 915 in that it creates a set of problems attempting to address the particulars of one isolated case, however we all may feel about that case. And I would just remind us all that that case is continuing to work its way through the court system, and perhaps this isn't the best forum for trying to make conclusions about the case, given that none of us has complete knowledge. In regards to the bill as introduced, we have great concern that it would restrict the authority of the director of the Building Codes Division to authorize local jurisdictions to deviate from the statewide building code in order to provide innovation and cost effectiveness. This is partially remedied in the Dash 2 amendments, but it is a concern worth noting because it has led to a more effective and efficient service at the municipal level around the state. We also have concern that it routes appeals of building code violations through the various specialty advisory boards, which are really suited to do the job that they currently do, and that is advise on the technical specifications of the state building code and handle appeals specifically on the technical nature of those codes. And then an element of the bill is introduced that is very clear and not so clear in the Dash 2 amendments that gives us great concern. Is the clause that creates a retroactive right to appeal under the new procedures put forth. That is really a can of worms waiting to happen in terms of opening up cases that have been thought to be settled. In the Dash 2 amendments, I would note for the committee that the language is somewhat ambiguous, but in Section 5 it does include the term or on appeal, so this could apply to cases that otherwise wouldn't fall under the rules set forth by the Dash 2 amendments. Beginning at the beginning of the Dash 2 amendments, under Section 2, it specifies that a municipal appeal must include an opportunity for public testimony. This strikes us as not being appropriate in the sense that the public would have had the opportunity to provide testimony on the development proposal at earlier stages, and to invite that at the appeal stage would open up what should be a ruling on a fairly technical or straightforward standard to the public at large commenting on whether they support or oppose the particular development. The language of Section 2 is potentially problematic in that it speaks to a prohibition on assessment of a criminal penalty. As you've heard, to my knowledge, municipalities around the state are citing alleged violators with a fine or an infraction, which is a civil penalty, but that is often referred to municipal court, which is the most local court, and it stands to reason that that court would handle interpretation of the local ordinance. And it should also be noted that though that is a criminal procedure in many respects affords greater levels of protection than the civil procedure process. Looking at Section 3, we have concerns that though much of the language of the bill as introduced has been removed, the new language specifically deletes lines 26 and 27 that make clear that the municipal ordinances, rules, and regulations may conflict with the state building code. We would ask why that language is being deleted and suggest that its deletion could be problematic in preventing municipalities from providing innovation at the local level. Section 4, it appears that it may, although providing appeal to a circuit court if the specialty advisory boards decline to hear a case on a technical matter, could potentially not allow for circuit courts to handle appeal from the administrative appeal process at the municipal level, rather sending that appeal directly to the Court of Appeals. Don't know why that would be advantageous, and just question why the amendment is written in that manner. As you've heard, the requirement that posting of a 100% surety bond putting a toll on the accrual of penalties could be problematic, not only in that oftentimes it's difficult to estimate the cost of remedying a violation, but also if there's a life safety issue at hand or a danger to the public, say improper installation of a backflow device or improper electrical wiring, it would make sense that the penalty continue to accrue to make sure that that violation does not go on any longer than absolutely necessary. And in regards to subsection 4 of section 4, there are cases where it would not make sense and is not required by state law to not issue a temporary certificate of occupancy, for instance, flood mitigation, where it may not fall under the fire and life safety compliance clause of subsection 4, where we believe it would be undesirable to require that municipalities issue a temporary certificate of occupancy pending all appeals, which could last for years. So we have a number of concerns with this bill, and with that, I'll conclude my testimony and welcome any questions. Thank you.
Well, I think we're going to move on at the moment. Thank you for that information. Our last one I have sent up to time, signed up, is Tom Phillips from the Oregon Building Officials Association.
Good afternoon. Welcome. Chair and committee. My name is Tom Phillips. I'm the building official for the City of Salem. I am not here on behalf of the City of Salem. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Building Officials Association. And to respect your time and not be too redundant, I'd just like to touch on a couple areas just to make sure that you know that I'm in agreement with some of the testimony that's come forth that's in opposition to this bill. First of all, the building code does have a proper appeal process. It does have the ability for a appeal to go through one of the program chiefs at the building codes division. This is a very fast and quick process that can be that an applicant can take advantage of. The way the bill is currently written, that would be a problem within ORS 455. Because it doesn't have a public hearing involved with it. The idea of it is to expedite the process. And then from there, that any decision made by the chief after that program chief can be appealed to the advisory board. I think that's what's been done in this case. Section 4, subsection 3, the bond issue, as was stated, one of the concerns we would have is if there's fire life safety issues, we'd be allowing occupants within a building to occupy a building, assuming it's safe, based upon a disagreement and a bond posted. This could be a sprinkler issue. This could be a boiler issue. It could be any kind of issue that may be that may jeopardize the occupants. So we would oppose that section. And then last but not least, the certificate of occupancy. Typically, certificate of occupancies, we employ the national standard that's done throughout the United States, in that a certificate of occupancy into a construction, into a building, does include all of the different ordinances and rules and even state laws that pertain to that structure. For us to limit the CBO just to the building code would only probably create a second type of process, because at some point in time you have to have compliance with city ordinances and other state laws. And so this, the CFO currently is a very good mechanism to make sure that the folks get all those kind of issues cleaned up. Again, if it's limited strictly to the building code, then what would may happen is we may be allowing people to move into buildings that don't have proper public improvements, that could have land use violations, those kind of things still pending out there, which then would, I think, cause us to have to create another mechanism. And so the building owner might have to run two or three different type of functions to get approval to go into their building that may be separate, because I can't imagine, for instance, public works issues being allowed to just not be adhered to through the CFO process. So, okay. Any questions with that?
Well, thank you, Mr. Phillips. I do appreciate that, and I appreciate your analysis. Any questions for Mr. Phillips? Yep. Senator George?
This is for you and also a couple of the speakers before you. It seems like to me that we have a slip in the law here that is clearly exposed in this one situation. And I'm wondering, had it not been in the case that we talked about earlier, had there not been the contractual obligation to a doctor to move into the office building, mm-hmm. if the landowner would have just been then at the mercy. In fact, what actually created or what exposed this problem was that there was contractual obligations on both sides. And ultimately, in this situation that we have, is it exposes the sheer power of this particular hammer that local jurisdictions have, because the landowner had had a contractual obligation with a third party. It seems like to me that even though we discuss that this is an isolated event, what it does demonstrate is that there's an immense amount of power that building codes officials have over landowners to get them to do things that may even violate the law at a different level. And I want you to kind of discuss that if you could, because to me, I know this sounds like a one case situation, but I'm wondering if it's not much more common. It's just that the landowner gives in rather than to appeal because of the sheer size of the hammer here.
Again, typically, I've been in this business for over 18 years, and typically there's an appeal process, and we do have one where they can directly go to the state if there's a disagreement. This one is kind of a unique situation because you have a disagreement of whether or not it's a building code issue or a land use issue. When that kind of thing comes up, you're going to have a question where two parties will disagree. Because one, for us to say that it's a building code issue, and then for another to say it's a land use issue, if I was to say as a building official it's a building code issue, then I may be actually hurting someone's rights to be able to pursue it under a land use issue. So again, there's an interpretation issue that's going on here, and if it was a strictly a building code issue, it would have been resolved. But again, there's a debate going on of whether or not it was a land use issue or a building code issue. Those are two different state laws, different ORSs, and certainly different rules. So,
thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Senator.
Thank you. I don't really have a question. I have more of a statement, and it goes along the lines of Senator George. I've had multiple conversations with commercial builders in the state who develop and build in jurisdictions all over. And there's no question in my mind and in their conversations to me that local governments use whatever tools necessary to, you know, make them jump through whatever hoops that are out there. And it always comes down to the point that the building community says to me, I wish they'd just tell me what the figure is. What's the dollar amount that they really want to get out of me? I'd rather just write the check so that I can move forward, get my building done, know what the playing field is, and then be able to account for that into the process and move ahead. Basically agreeing with Senator George that local governments do have all the cards, and for the business side, they just figure, you know, what are the rules? Tell me what the rules are. If, you know, tell me what size of the check I got to write. Because ultimately, from their perspective, that's what it tends to be, that they look at it as local governments trying to get their pound of flesh so that they can build what they want to build. I think there's a problem here. I'm not exactly sure what the solution is, if this is exactly the right place to go. But I see an imbalance in power, and I think that we need to rectify it.
Thank you, sir. Thank you. If it's okay, I think we need to move on from this issue right now. We're way over time.
Great. Thank you, sir.
So we'll consider this, though. We may be bringing this bill back, but I think you've given us all some good information on how to do this. So with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 915. Thank you, Senator Verger, for allowing me to move on. Okay, we'll talk about public hearing on Senate Joint Resolution 21. This is a measure that actually overrides the original measure. So I'll just turn over to Mr. Stembridge briefly, and then we have some people to report to us.
My understanding is that the Dash 2 amendment will be the focus of the hearing today. It replaces the measure. It directs the Department of Administrative Services and the State Treasurer to inventory contracts involving the State of Oregon with the insurance underwriter, AIG, and its subsidiaries, and to report to the Legislative Assembly by September 1st, 2009, on the related risks and efforts to reduce those risks.
Thank you, Mr. Stembridge. Colleagues, I had this drafted for the purpose of having this committee hear from some of the folks in state government, as with all the issues going on with American International Group and its many, many subsidiaries and the various risks involved, and reading things that you probably have and the Wall Street and others about systemic risks that many states or municipalities may be exposed to. I think it would be valuable for this committee to hear things are moving as to what risks, if any, the state may be exposed to and what steps we were taking to mitigate those risks. And the last thing we ever want to be in is a situation where, well, we never bothered to ask. So we're going to ask some of those questions today. I want to appreciate your participation in that. I'm going to ask Debbie Fifield from the Department of Administrative Services to come forward. Is she here? Or who else is from DAS? Laura Lockwood McCall, representing Treasury. And I don't have Corey here. Is there someone else from DCBS? Who's
here?
Oh, there
Corey
she is. Oh, you were hiding back there. And Corey Streisinger from DCBS. And there are some things in our, I believe you have in your packet, at least they were delivered to me. I hope that if not, they will be delivered to you. But as a background, again, there's, as we all know, the federal government, which has invested almost a couple hundred million dollars in AIG for the purpose of trying to systematically break this organization apart so it doesn't have systemic risk to our economy. And, you know, our issues are what type of risk do we have with that? So I think what I'll start with is Ms. Lockwood McCall, from Treasury standpoint, just to tell us a little bit about what you have learned and what Treasury is doing regards to these types of risks.
Thank you. For the record, Laura Lockwood McCall, Director of Debt Management in the Office of State Treasurer. As a debt manager for the state, we issue various bonds, and we often find that in the realm of debt management, at least, that the construction proceeds, for example, we could earn a better rate of return through an investment agreement than we can in the short-term fund, because it's obviously a 2 to 3 year construction project, and the short-term fund is for liquidity, which is very short investments. So we often bid out what's called guaranteed investment agreements through competitive bid. And lo and behold, over many years, AIG has often won those contracts, because for many years it was a AAA, and that's who we usually bid them out to, is double and triple A's. So we did have some exposure in that regard. We also have debt service reserve funds for our lottery revenue bonds where we put the money in reserve and we use it to make the final payment on a bond issue. And during the meantime, it generates interest earnings. And again, it can earn a higher rate of return in a guaranteed investment agreement with a highly rated counterparty than it could in the short-term funds, lowers our budget costs, and saves taxpayers money. So when AIG had its great spectacular explosion back in September, we took a look at all of our different investment agreements, and we had a construction agreement that they had won in competitive bid, highest rate, for the University of Oregon basketball arena, proceeds of approximately $173 million. Now, our agreements are designed by the Department of Justice, and they always have out provisions, and generally it's built around credit quality. So as AIG announced its problems and the fact that it was going to go from a double A minus to bankruptcy in a matter of moments, as it was downgraded by the rating agencies, it gave us options to get our money back, which is how our collateralized agreements are designed. And we chose to get the money back, and the proceeds came back to the short-term fund, and they went from earning 3.75% to whatever the short-term fund was, and now it's about 1.6. So we unfortunately lost some of the earnings and some of the sort of cost efficiencies, but we got our money back, and all is well in the world. We do have lottery debt service reserve funds for four different series of lottery bonds. And the decision was made, and there's people here from DAS if you're interested in hearing, that the rates of return that we had earned were awfully attractive. And we went ahead and allowed them to post collateral, and that collateral is at 104 to 105% of the fair market value of what's posted. It's all U.S. direct obligations or subsidiaries of the federal government, so Fannie Mae's, things like that. And so currently we have roughly $25 million in collateral on about $22.9 million in investments. Now, if we were to take the money back, we would put it in the short-term fund, and again, it would mean that the debt service costs on our lottery bonds would be a bit higher. And obviously, if the situation continues to deteriorate, that is an option that we can pursue. Those are the only exposures we have in terms of debt management at this time. We've had other investment agreements, other agencies at different times have invested, but currently that's the four corners of my world. There are other investments through the investments division, and I would ask Ron Schmitz to come forward if you want to do treasury in its totality at this point.
I think we probably should. So. Corey, if you want to step aside just for a second here, because we just received some of that information this morning.
I would like to add one other thought. I noticed in the master list when we met on Friday of all the different types of insurance, and there's 250 subsidiaries of AIG. I noticed mortgage guarantee. And so if you are so interested, we can give you testimony from both Oregon Housing and as well as Oregon Veterans Services. Both use one particular mortgage insurer, which is UGRI. And for some of our veterans and some of our first-time homebuyer loans, they're currently still the highest rated of all the mortgage insurance companies in the United States, but it is an AIG-owned subsidiary, if you want to hear about it.
Thank you. We'll start with Mr. Metzger.
Thank you, Senator Metzger, Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Ron Schmitz, Director of the Investment Division. I act as the Chief Investment Officer for the various funds under Treasury's management. This would include OPERF, the Pension Fund, Common School Fund, State Accident Insurance Fund, and the Short-Term Fund primarily. There are a variety of other small offshoot funds to the Short-Term Fund that we manage for various state agencies as well. Just to give you an update on the status of the exposure that we have to AIG, had or have to AIG, as of October 31st, we held approximately 1 million shares of AIG stock in the pension portfolio. Subsequent to the announcement of the federal bailout, these funds that were managed through external equity managers were sold at a realized loss of approximately $43 million. This represents less than 0.1% of the value of the pension portfolio. At the same time, October 31st, 2008, several bond managers in both the pension portfolio, the SAFE portfolio, and the Common School Fund owned $41 million, $15 million, and $380,000 par value of AIG bonds, respectively. At the announcement of the bailout, about a third of those assets were sold, realizing a loss of $10 million. The remaining two-thirds of that initial par value at October 31 is still held, approximately $37 million, with a current value of about $11 million. So all told in the bond portfolio, about a $37 million loss, again, less than 0.1% of the assets. In addition to the above, I would mention that both OPERF, State Accident Insurance Fund, and the Common School Fund, as well as the short-term fund, own about $116 million par value of investments in AIG subsidiaries. These subsidiaries don't have a parent company guarantee. They're traded and rated separately. The par value or the market value of those investments at this point in time is approximately $91 million, so they're trading significantly better than the parent company debt. I would comment that the portfolio managers that we use and that we partner with are all legal fiduciaries to the funds that we manage. They make independent investment decisions. There are a variety of different managers across the portfolios that would have been in and out of AIG bonds over the course of the years and over the course of the months in question. Why some sell, I don't have the information right with me. If you wanted to see it, I could tell you why some managers made the decision to sell and why others decided to hold. I could speculate, but it would be pure speculation. Finally, the last thing I'd mention before turning it over to questions, if there were any, is that we are working with DOJ to assess what legal options we have to ensure that we're doing all that we can to protect the existing investments we have and to see what, if any, legal action might help enhance any recovery efforts.
Thank you, Mr. Smith. And I want to get to that part of it first, because you'll notice in the sheet, which my colleagues just handed out to you, that was given to me this morning, I thought you had it. You say the state has initiated some litigation over AIG and has since found more information that you are reviewing. Can you give us some extent to what that is and to what exposure, if anything, that means to us as a state?
Chair Metzger, members of the committee, I can't say too much on advice of counsel from DOJ, but prior to the existing deterioration of AIG and the federal bailout, we had began investigating based on the Elliott Spitzer's actions in the state of New York with respect to some bid rigging that AIG and other insurance companies had done, and some of the activities and business practices that they did in placing insurance through their brokerage subsidiaries. We are investigating that, and again, that's the source of the original action from a year or two ago. More recently, again, it's been more specific to the bailout and the current situation with the Financial Products Division of AIG. We don't know what at this point, what potential sources would allow us to take action there, but we're assessing that as we speak. And again, the DOJ doesn't want me to get too specific beyond that. And I apologize for that. It's not me, it's them.
I understand. That's how they always are, right? I mean, lawyers are like that. Is it your best estimate, since this is kind of your portfolio is managing this part of Treasury, that any downside, further downside in terms of our from the investment side with AIG is pretty well limited to the sheet in front of us? I mean, most of the losses have been pretty well realized, and other than those that are still at risk with the current holdings to the level that they have been articulated here, would you say that is a limitation of our risk currently?
Chair Metzger, to the best of my knowledge at this point in time, the $11 million current market value would be the extent of any exposure we have across all the portfolios we manage. So, yes, the lion's share of losses have occurred already.
Okay.
And take the form of both realized as well as paper losses.
Okay, thank you. Questions for the Treasury? Okay, thank you, guys. Corey, you can come back up, but I think we'll go with Department of Administrative Services next. We're probably dealing more on the insurance side.
Chair Metzger, Co-Chair Starr, and members of the committee, my name is Deborah Fifield, and I'll be presenting testimony on behalf of DAS Risk Management. You may be aware that DAS Risk Management is responsible for providing all insurance except employee benefits for state agencies. We're also responsible to maintain an actuarially sound self-insurance fund and to provide or contract for risk management services to the state. In that context, I'll respond to the questions that were posed by Senator Metzger. The first first question was, how closely are we involved with AIG and its subsidiaries in ensuring State of Oregon funds and obligations? The State Commercial Insurance Program currently includes 12 AIG subsidiaries, which you can see on the AIG organization chart to the far left. We would have coverages that are placed in the commercial insurance, the foreign general, and the Hartford steam boiler subsidiaries. They provide $178 million aggregate coverage, and the total premiums are $2.5 million. The largest policy by far is the property insurance policy, and that accounts for $2 million of the premium and the vast majority of the aggregate coverage that's afforded. The second question that was posed is, what risks are there in continuing to do business with AIG and its subsidiaries? DAS Risk Management believes the risk is minimal, and there are essentially three reasons for that. First is that this group of subsidiaries are admitted to do business by DCBS in the state of Oregon. All of the carriers have a rating of A- or better, with A- being excellent. And also, we are monitoring closely and have our insurance broker monitoring as well. The final question is, what is the state doing to minimize these risks? Part of the annual renewal process with all of our insurance coverages is to analyze the competitive marketplace and to get bids from various insurance carriers. We are, of course, continuing to do that. For AIG companies and subsidiaries, and in fact now for all insurance carriers, we're doing a verification with DCBS before coverage is placed. Also, an additional layer of due diligence is with our broker, Willis of Oregon. Willis has a requirement, and compliance with that is mandatory for their approved list of carriers, that all carriers have a minimum A- best rating and a minimum policyholder surplus of $100 million. So we feel that with these layers of monitoring and due diligence, that at this point we are in a fairly good minimal risk posture as to the insurance carriers with whom we're dealing. And in fact, I would say that with our excess property policy in particular, we've had very good experience in managing a catastrophic loss, which was the Capitol Fire. They were very quick. AIG Lexington was very, very quick to respond. And in fact, we're on site within 24 hours of the telephone report of the fire. They have paid $2 million in advance payments to date against that $2 million premium and are continuing to work very, very closely with both the claim management function and DAS Risk Management and Legislative Administration to complete that restoration in a timely manner. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you, Ms. Fifo. So then the AIG, they insure the entire Capitol building then? Is that what? Okay.
That's correct.
Okay.
That's a great question.
Senator Starr.
Thank you. You mentioned the state self-insurance fund. Question I have is, and its capitalization, are we as a state in good shape in that particular fund? And in our 07-09 rebalance, did we take money out of that fund in order to balance? And can you just make a quick comment on your satisfaction that we're in good shape in the event of a more catastrophic fire event or perhaps a catastrophic earthquake event that might potentially occur?
Senator Starr, members of the committee, in fact, money was swept from the self-insurance fund. That fund has different cells, and the money flows between those cells. Where we identified the opportunity to take some funds was in the workers' compensation program, which is the most stable component of the self-insurance fund. There is pending legislation, SB 311, which will increase tort limits, and there is certainly very close attention being paid to that legislation and the potential impact on the self-insurance fund. Because the self-insurance fund funding requirement is based on historic information and we don't yet have the advantage of knowing what that impact will be, we do have to have the caveat in place that should there be an increased volume or an increased severity of claims as a result of that legislation, that we would have to adjust the funding requirement for the self-insurance fund and in turn the risk charges to all the state agencies. But for right now, we believe that we are in viable condition. Does that answer your question?
That was responsive. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Other questions for Ms. Fifield? I just had one. I mean, you know, in your job at risk management, it has to be somewhat unsettling over the last year or so as it is for anybody in your capacity, when you're relying so much on the ratings of the various carriers that we're dealing with, when those things can change overnight. I mean, the due diligence that you hope is being done isn't necessarily reliable. I don't know from a confidence factor, you know, how that changes how you assess risk, but it's got to make that job more difficult.
Senator Metzger and members of the committee, you're absolutely correct. It does indeed. And as a matter of fact, we were in the process of renewing the property coverage, and we're on the cusp of completing that renewal when last September the news about the potential bailout of AIG occurred. So we did have to move very quickly to reassess the marketplace and to verify that we would be in a sound fiscal position if we move forward with them. So you're correct.
I have one other question. Have you, by chance, been in contact with any of your counterparts in other states, sharing information about these types of risks, or had any other experiences in talking to other folks that may not be quite as or as less vulnerable as perhaps we may be in that area?
Senator Metzger and members of the committee, yes, we do participate in the self-insurance and the state risk management association, PREMA. There is information that is actively being shared by all of the different state risk managers. And, of course, this is an issue that presents a great deal of volatility and concern for all state risk managers. So we are sharing on a real-time basis our experiences and hope to benefit from that.
Okay, thank you. Senator George.
Thank you. I don't think you can answer this in this forum, but sometime I'd like to maybe have a conversation with you. I wonder, when I first heard the news of AIG's bailout, the thing that came to my mind is the thought is, how is it possible that we get to a point where we have a business that's too big to fail? And is it that all of the states and governments that participate in the insurance program, we have this requirement that they meet a certain quality, like A-minus? Do we perpetuate that as a group, all the states and all the local municipalities, in actually rewarding the larger and just continue to roll up bigger and bigger institutions such as AIG? Are we perpetuating that problem as individual states?
Senator Metzger and members of the committee, I think that's an extremely interesting question that I would be very happy to discuss with you offline. I don't think it's within the scope of the testimony I prepared for today, but indeed that is an interesting question.
Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Streisinger.
Thank you, Senator. For the record, I'm Corey Streisinger, Director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services, and I've been asked to comment briefly on the regulatory structure that we deal with relating to AIG. And to start with, it's worth keeping in mind that American International Group, Inc., which is the large financial services holding company, is the entity that has received the federal attention. And although it is sometimes characterized in the media as an insurance company, technically it is not. It owns a lot of insurance companies. It owns a lot of other types of financial services companies, some of which are regulated and some of which are not. At the state level, we regulate insurance companies. Insurance is largely regulated at the state level throughout this country. And we regulate a number of AIG insurance subsidiaries that are authorized to do business in Oregon. There are 43 insurance subsidiaries owned by the AIG umbrella company that have certificates of authority here in Oregon. There's also a consumer finance company, American General Financial Services, that has 25 branches licensed by us here in Oregon. So the insurance subsidiaries that do business here in Oregon cover property and casualty, workers' compensation, life insurance, annuity. Approximately 9% of the workers' compensation coverage in Oregon is provided by AIG subsidiaries. Approximately 9% of the annuity coverage. Those are the collectively the largest business lines, but as you've heard from others testifying, the state and others have do business with other AIG subsidiaries as well. Many of them do not use the name AIG in 21st Century Insurance, American International Pacific, Hartford Steam Boiler, National Union Fire Insurance, Sun America Life, Variable Annuity Life, or VALIC. Those are some of the common insurance names that you might not associate with AIG. They are AIG subsidiaries. Now, with respect to our regulatory role and state's regulatory role generally, insurance companies need to meet certain solvency standards. They need to have reserves and capital and surplus on hand to meet standards that are administered at the state level but that states collaborate on and that are fairly consistent across the country. With respect to the AIG subsidiaries that have certificates of authority here in Oregon, all of them do meet state solvency requirements. We don't currently have concerns about their solvency. So as you are looking at the risks posed by doing business with AIG, it is worth keeping in mind what part of AIG you are dealing with and what standards we apply in our regulatory role. So happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Dreisinger. Questions, Mr. George?
I don't understand, or thank you very much for testifying. I don't really understand the structure of and these subsidiaries and how they relate to us as far as insurance. Mm-hmm. So when you create an insurance subsidiary of an institution such as AIG, is that institution totally separate in as much as if the parent fails, does then the subsidiary also fail, and do we recognize that within our regulatory structure?
Mr. Chair, Senator George, actually, if the parent fails, the subsidiary does not fail.
Okay.
The subsidiary is required almost as a standalone to have its own capitalization that's sufficient to meet regulatory requirements. So the subsidiaries that are owned by AIG actually are the value in AIG and could be sold off or spun off or reorganized to create value. So, in fact, when the news came about AIG and the federal bailout, one of the responses by state insurance regulators was to make sure that those subsidiaries were themselves meeting appropriate capitalization requirements. And now, the reverse is not true. That is, if a subsidiary fails, it could affect a holding company.
Sure.
But our role as regulators is to make sure that the subsidiaries keep the capital that they need to keep at the subsidiary level. The challenges, of course, is that some of the unregulated subsidiaries created significant risks that are obviously creating challenges at the holding company level as well. And you may have heard a lot of discussion about credit default swaps, for example, which meet the characteristics of an insurance product, but by federal law are defined as non-insurance. So those were taking place in non-insurance subsidiaries.
Yeah, but they don't have an effect on the subsidiaries that we regulate for insurance purposes.
Mr. Chair, Senator George, that's correct.
Okay, great. Thank you very much.
But, and that brings up one question I would have. We often have that discussion between state regulation, federal regulation, jurisdiction, et cetera. As a result of any of the activities, the economic activities of the last year or so, has your department, and maybe even in conjunction with Department of Justice, from a state level, is there any other, firewalls or layers of protection for those doing business in the state from a state standpoint that you see may be necessary, or gaps that you have seen that you may be coming to the legislature to try and cover? Or do you believe our regulatory system is either unable to have any impact in any of the types of things that have unfolded, or do not have jurisdictional bounds to do that?
Well, Mr. Chair, it's obviously a very complex issue, and there's a lot of discussion about whether insurance should continue to be regulated at the state level or the national level, and the AIG discussion has provoked a lot of that, although it's been a subject of discussion for a number of years. I think many would say, and of course I have a vested interest, but I would probably agree that actually the state regulatory system has worked pretty well. We have not seen regulated insurance companies failing and have not seen them being subject to the same challenges at the national level. But there's no question that there's a need for continued and even heightened regulatory oversight right now. One of the challenges that a number of insurance companies has faced, for particular lines of insurance in particular, they have those capital holdings, those reserves, are held in various types of financial assets. And those financial assets have been affected by the economic downturn. No surprise. surprise, but for a company that depends for its solvency on holding a large portfolio of financial assets, this has been a challenging time, and there are life insurance companies in particular around the country, AIG subsidiaries, other life insurance companies, that are seeing their portfolios under stress because of what's been happening in financial sectors. And we are monitoring our Oregon-domiciled companies closely. Other states are monitoring their companies. You know, the one challenge that we have is, of course, although these are standards that are reasonably consistent around the country, each state nevertheless has the primary role with regulation of their own domiciliary companies, and so we work with other states, but a company that is regulated in another state is subject to the oversight of that state's regulator on a primary basis. Nevertheless, I think the state regulatory system allows closer contact and I guess more high touch, if you will, oversight than I think would a single federal regulator.
Thank you, Mr. Reisinger. Any other questions? Well, first of all, thank you very much for that information. I think that was very helpful. One thing I want to add, you'll get this by email, is that we received on the Oregon Housing and Community Services Department, which does mortgages, and there was an email that Jim will forward on to you that we do have over $36 million in mortgages from Oregon Housing and Community Services that the mortgage insurance is provided by AIG, so that's another piece of information that will just come to you.
Mr. Chairman, I wanted to mention that that will also be in the committee record.
And that, yes, thank you very much, and we'll put that in the committee record. But as of now, anyway, based on the testimony today, it looks like we don't have the severe issues that some of our brethren may be facing. I see the state of Michigan has filed suit because just about everything was insured and have faced tremendous losses there. And it sounds like we have managed our risk portfolio. Obviously, we got losses, but overall, which is not to be unexpected, but the risk has not been systemic, which I think is important for citizens to know. Thank you very much. Thank you, committee. And Mr. Stembridge for Wednesday.
Golly
on Wednesday, and we're going to have lots of
We have two items on Wednesday, and I don't remember. Karen, do you remember what they were?
That's okay. We'll look them up. We're adjourned.